This is at Trustworthy Slav.
This is at Incognito, COH.
CRKBlack.com build.
This is the Fed Post.
Yeah, and there were a lot of articles about, there's Bernie to Trump voters, which is funny because I was one of those people. I went from Bernie and I ended up voting for Trump. And a lot of that was because, you know, Bernie would go up and say, these are fundamentally good people, blah, blah, blah. And Trump would go up and say, I paid all these people. They're all corrupt. these people are bad. The GOP is bad.
He'd say these people are sick.
These people are sick, and they're pro regime change, and you know, none of that money. There's crumbling bridges here, and we're going to war. What's that about? You know, so there were overlaps, and there were things of him, like you said, like smashing the establishment that like appealed to me. And you know, if you're gonna look at the two of them as like Bernie's sort of on the wave of Occupy Wall Street, and Trump is on the wave of the Tea Party, and they're just riding that wave, and they're not really gonna fundamentally change anything. They're just sort of like they're up for election, so there's only so much resistance they can give. They're sort of mm-hmm. like they're confined to being presidential candidates. You know, they can't be that revolutionary. Trump was better, in my opinion, because at least he sort of demonized these people and sort of like call them on their shit, basically. But that's sort of another thing. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things I was trying to get to of like crime. Yeah, crime and media and all that. But like, as far as the right left paradigm in general, like I just wonder, mm-hmm. like, do you think that's still a useful paradigm in general? Because, you know, you see a lot, especially now, especially after Trump lost, there's so many homeless people of the right and the left, because Biden's up and nobody wanted him, in my opinion, on the left or the right. Or at least they say they didn't, on the dissident end, at least, of both wings. And, there's sort of like this kind of aimlessness, and there's people like crossing over and making appeals to the other side.
Trump, too, like some of his messaging economically was kind of left or appealed a little bit more left than traditional Republicans have.
Right, right, right. Exactly. The anti-regime change stuff. I mean, that's sort of like across the board. I just wonder if you feel like this paradigm is something that's outdated, or it's just going to get, a firmware update as we get into like the 2020s, or what do you make of it?
Well, you know, I have a couple thoughts on that. A lot of this is just baked into our system, mm-hmm. you know. We can blame the cultural currents or social media or the changing media, and all of those things have they play a part. But at the end of the day, we're one of the few democracies in the world that has a first past the post system where, you know, the winner with the most votes wins. And, you know, like just mathematically, you're going to get basically a two-party system. And given that we're like a Western country, and, you know, it's kind of ironic. It's like all these postmodern leftists hate, you know, Western ideals, or they hate kind of liberal democracy, but then they see the world in this Manichaean good evil, almost like medieval European way. That's exactly the same as what, you know, a lot of these liberals have always believed. But, you know, I don't find it useful at all to see it through a left right thing. Mm-hmm. It's hard to break out of that mold when the media tells you to do that. When we have this two party system, when we have this polarized kind of media landscape. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can be staring at a screen or reading a magazine or listening to whatever kind of political content as a political hobbyist. And then you break away and you talk to any normal person, and the average person, just these labels never apply. Go to a working class bar, go to some, you know, go anywhere in this country, whether it's an all white farm town in Southern Virginia, or go to the bar by my house that's mostly Latino in San Francisco, and it's, you know, mostly working class folks. They all have the same concerns. People care about their family. You know, they're culturally open-minded. Americans are actually very anti-racist. They're very open to different cultures. People don't give a shit if they marry outside of their tribe or race or whatever. Like, and I'm saying this comparatively, compared to any other, go anywhere in the world, we're the least racist, maybe except for Canada. Mm-hmm. They want a higher income. They want to be able to afford a home. Mm-hmm. They want their kids to succeed, and they want politicians to deliver. And they think the system's corrupt. Whether you're right wing or left wing or Democrat or Republican, people want the same thing. So these labels, the slogans, and they want safety. You know, everyone's actually against crime, despite what the media says.
Absolutely.
Literally everyone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It's just these people who grew up in these ultra safe, privileged cushions where, you know, maybe they were skateboarding outside of their prep school and a cop told them no, and that's their only interaction with the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
But, you know, for folks exactly. who are actually living in places with high crime and they know they have friends and family who have been murdered, you know, not by cops, but by criminals, because right. it's over like petty bullshit that gets people killed every day in America. No, crime is real. And that comes first before your healthcare premiums or whatever, you know, yeah. like that's the top concern. But no, the left-right paradigm is antiquated. It doesn't make sense. It's forced upon us. It's getting worse mm-hmm. because of polarization. But we see it in the true kind of elegance of Trump was that he was one of the few politicians who could really game the system in the media and smash through these artificial walls. That's what was appealing about Bernie. And a few other politicians are capable of breaking through this wall. I mean, we see it a little bit with Tulsi, a little bit mm-hmm. with Josh Hawley and others, but not really. It's still very difficult to pierce through because every political and financial incentive tugs you to one extreme.
Yep. I was actually about to mention that like I find a lot of times these labels from my own specific political journey, as well as my co-host on his podcast, labels often cause a lot more trouble and keep people trapped in dogma a lot more than they actually help as a holistic method for understanding what's actually happening within politics. Yeah. And, you know, when I think it holds populism back a lot, I think it hampers any populist project because you end up being a left populist or a right populist. And when you really get down to the basis of things, you find that most people, individuals, they're not really neatly left nor right. And so a true populist project can't be something that is, you know, starkly on one side of the aisle. And so that was one thing I did want to kind of poke into is what kind of rising stars or any type of hope you might see being a little bit more plugged into the political media landscape as far as populist politicians or maybe groups or anything that are kind of coming on the landscape beyond maybe like a Tulsi. Because I think Tulsi is like not quite like you were saying there, she's not able to really escape that binary that much. She can signal it, but she's still ultimately tied into, you know, the system in itself.
Well, there's a lot of happening right now around the vaccine mandates, around just calling out yeah. this hypocrisy around the lockdowns or on privacy. I mean, this was the other thing about the lockdowns. It's like, do you remember the New York Times and others did all these big spreads on how your phones are collecting all this data and you don't know it. Mm-hmm. And without your consent, these third party ad brokers are building really sophisticated profiles on you that can even track you as you go home or go to the bathroom or, you know, do whatever, and potentially track you when you go to a protest. I mean, this was what the New York Times explicitly reported on in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then in 2020, the same ad brokers offered everyone's data to show who was breaking lockdown and do little maps of people, you know, going to states like Florida where they had looser laws, or going to protests in Michigan to protest these new measures. And suddenly the media celebrates ad brokers because
contact tracing.
Yes, it's giving us a wide spectrum view on everyone's bad behavior. You know, it's like the principles just radically change overnight. And mm-hmm. yep. you know, we just haven't had, there are people like Tucker Carlson who have a large platform who can call out these hypocrisies, but we don't have, I think there's just a huge space right now for someone who can call out these cultural hypocrisies, whether it's like inserting, racial segregation in public schools under the guise of racial justice, saying that, you know, white, black and Asian kids need different affinity groups to learn or something. Like the folks who wanted to call this stuff out on the cultural side, there are a number of figures on the right, but who can also rope in a material, an economic, a financial, a labor-backed perspective. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a clear figure there. I think that there's a huge lane that's open right now, but I don't know. I mean, I'd ask you guys if there's a populist figure or movement that really fits that mold.
I think that's kind of a lot of what my project is as an individual interested in politics is kind of raising the call for that type of figure. Because I think that, like, obviously yeah. I don't think that people really bend the course of history to their will as much as people can ride trends, and they can mm-hmm. kind of ride social energies and trends that are already happening. And so I think that a lot of the utility, I think, for us as a podcast is kind of trying to voice that need for a populist figure. And I think that raising the call for that, I'm hoping in the back of my mind that someday, you know, we get more voices kind of amplifying that, and we can see someone come out. But I also think that, like, obviously part of the system is built around keeping that from really ever coming into fruition, because it's so at odds with the, you know, the agenda of the powers that be and the ruling class. So I think that there's utility in raising a call for that, and then also saying, well, do you see how right now there is no voice that's active in that realm? And it's because of the fact that, you know, these institutions and these parties that we're tied to are set up to keep that type of dissident voice out. And so that kind of, to me, speaks to the fact that we would need some sort of new political paradigm in general, outside of that, outside of the two-party thing and as a whole.
Yeah, I'm interested in working on somehow bringing more kind of proportional voting to this country. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to get this started. But I think one kind of simple kind of firmware update is just, hey, you know, all legislative voting in America, whether it's the city council or for the U.S. Senate or House, is gerrymandered. Like, why is North Dakota shaped that way and they get two senators? Why in San Francisco, you know, which is supposedly open-minded, you have like a 15 to 20% of the population is Republican, but zero members of the city council? Is that gerrymandering, or is that just like our kind of system? So like in a lot of Asian and European more modern democracies, they have a system where seats are awarded based on the percentage of the vote. So if you've got your Fed Post party and it gets 5% of the vote, they get 5% of the seats. You know, you don't need to win a whole lot. And that way, I think it deflates a lot of the polarization and extremism, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. everyone needs a seat at the table, right? Like,
definitely.
Even if you have some wacko, insane views, you know, would you rather those people try to capture one of the two major parties or go off and form their insane street movement? You know, like, or do you want to just let them be at the table of governance, but then just let them kind of have their 4 or 5% seats and let it be? You know, like, let's actually have a competitive open system where all voices are heard. If you want your identitarian, you know, woke party, put it to the ballot and just put, then don't infiltrate the social democratic or populist left party. You know, like, let's have all voices heard. I think that's better. That's one fix that I think is actually compatible with our society. Some of the other stuff I think we need to do is just a little bit more extreme. I mean, like, and I think kind of unworkable with, in terms of, like, I think Europe has just the more sober minded, publicly funded news would be mm-hmm. nice, but it's not compatible now with our like digital landscape. No one's going to switch on to the government funded NPR, you know, like, and it probably wouldn't work here. You know, so I think that helps in like Germany, where I just went to Germany to observe their chancellor election. And it was just incredible. Like, even with the internet, 75% of the country just watches the extremely boring chancellor debates and form their opinion off of that. And there's no like personal insults. It's like sober minded management style and policy questions, and that's it. You know, I don't think we're ever going to get there given the culture and society we're in. But in terms of like changing the way we vote for parties, I think that's viable, at least in my mind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. A parliamentary thing, a proportional thing where there's sort of more niche, because like, you know, I've recently learned that the right has a lot of, I've learned more of the nuance of how the right disagrees with each other. There's a lot of factions within there. Of course, the left has that. But because of this two-party thing, there's sort of this binary where people feel like, well, I have to be on this team, I have to take this, and you sort of have to adopt some of these issues, or at least feel like you're wedded to them.
It would be to so some degree. It would be so healthy for the right if they could actually form separate coherent parties and duke mm-hmm. it out, like,
yeah.
And I think it would gain respect for some people on the left, like in Germany, just meeting some of the, even the supposedly scary fascist party, the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. It's like, you know, they're like anti-immigrant, whatever, nationalists. So like people tag them as neo-Nazi. I mean, it's whatever. There are some kooks there, but then I guess some of them make some interesting points. And then you have the Christian Democrats or the Bavarian Sister Party, and like they can all operate, and voters have a choice. You know, if you want the kind mm-hmm. of center-right Romney-style Republican versus the, I don't know, the Paul Gosar party, like, give people the choice.
And you get to talk about specific tendencies in isolation, as opposed to where this thing of all these tendencies get lumped into one thing because it's strategically advantageous to one party to, you know, they're doing calculations of like, oh, if we hedge and get this group and that group and merge them together, then we get this amount of votes. They're doing all this calculus, but and that's where things get conflated and people get confused. But if you can get to isolate the tendencies, then you can have like more of a transparent conversation, which, yeah, I totally agree with.
That conflation is like where they lose me a lot of the time, because I'm not actually down with half that shit, though, man.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of right-leaning things that I feel open-minded to. I feel like I've gotten rid of all the social. I used to be more of a wokey, and I've gotten rid of all my social concerns, and now I just prioritize the economic things. And there's a lot of economic things that align with what some people on the right want. So there's that, but then there's all this other stuff with the right, these other social things that I don't feel connected to. And then I feel like, you know, it's hard to claim it, because then you get tugged in with all this other stuff. But if things were isolated, you know, I think it'd be a lot more clear as to where people stand. But I mean, so much confusion. People get straw-manned and they get mad.
A little bit, like New Zealand adopted the German system, and a few other countries have it, although it's relatively rare. They have mixed member proportional, meaning you get two votes. You get your vote for your local candidate, and then you vote party list. You just vote party, and the party has their list, and depending on the percentage, they fill out the list. But then the beginning part of the list is based on that first vote. So people kind of have a choice. So if you had the choice, maybe in some respect that you want to promote your far right candidate for a local district, but then you want to also influence the power position of the center left, and you can vote in your second vote. I think that works a lot. There's a lot of political science papers written about how this is the most fair and balanced system, and it seems to work pretty well in New Zealand, although New Zealand has its own problems. But yeah, you know, having that isolation where you can say, okay, if a political party wants to be a dictatorship, if the Fed Post creates a political party and they make all the rules,
which we will soon.
Yeah. Once I implemented PR, you guys should step up. But like, if you do this, you could have each party form its own rules. It's kind of ridiculous that because we have a two-party system, they have to comply with these democratic small d mandates, that they open it up and have this primary system. Every party should decide. If you want to have an open primary and people vote for your nominees, do it. If you want to have a dictatorship and you just give the people your political candidates and they have to choose, and you all have the same ideology, great too. Just like let the parties pick too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where, I mean, earlier you were asking just about like who out of, you know, current politicians any of us like. And I would say that like if there was, you know, an election tomorrow or something, I would still, you know, vote for either, you know, Trump or a DeSantis. And that comes with a big asterisk for me. And it's informed in a big way with by what we were just discussing, which is just like the current electoral system is just untenable as it currently is, right? Yeah. And so to the extent that I'd be voting for a Ron DeSantis or a Donald Trump, I'm voting for the Republican Party, and that's not something I'm stoked on, right?
Of course.
But right, this kind of like current brand of populist politician, sort of. As far as I can tell, it's, I guess, the closest thing to just challenging and trying to destabilize that electoral system. I see DeSantis like making hay out of pushing back on COVID policies. Like that stuff. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, Trump's very famous little call out of the donors and everything. And I mean, I would vote for people for those reasons alone.
Yeah.
And I guess it is like my position there does just kind of speak to like how impoverished the choices really are. Cause I'm not saying that I love DeSantis and I love Trump. But yeah, I mean, to the extent that, I mean, like a couple elections ago, you know, I'm looking through my voters pamphlet and I'm just like, literally just filling in. I'm literally voting for like the weird wacko QAnon people. Cause it's just going to stir things up to a greater extent. I mean, you know, maybe that's stirring the pot a little much, but
based.
I think that just to answer that question of like who I like as far as populists go, that's kind of where I'm at this point. And that's ultimately my ideal, but with the current situation, I think.
Yeah, that's where it's frustrating is that like through that two-party system, like no one's actually ever wanting to vote for the people that they end up having to vote for most of the time. Like I know that Like, I know a lot of people that voted for Biden that they profess that they didn't want to vote for Biden and it's not their first choice and all this and that. And like, I actually believe him because, I mean, fucking, of course he isn't. What do you see out of that man that's something that you'd want to vote for that's inspiring? And so the only thing is that, oh, well, he's just the one that's supporting our team. And it goes the same way with these other times that you, you know, it's like the old cliche of like voting for the lesser of two evils. But you still end up getting evil every single time. And it's just, it gets really frustrating. But then you see, like, for me, I get really skeptical of someone like Ron DeSantis because he seems like he's not, like, he is trying to pick up the affectation of populism, but in a way that's a little bit more tenable and safe for the system and for the party as well. He doesn't seem like quite as much of an outlier as someone like Trump that's going to shake things up. But I am very strongly drawn to him for his COVID policy. And I think that, like, right now, COVID is kind of a wedge issue for me. It's quickly turned into one over the past couple of years because I think it's very telling as to how they would respond to a lot of other stuff as well.
Like, not to beat this PR proportional drum too much, but one last thought is that, you know, the like Time magazine and all these whatever glossy magazines would have these like top feminist leaders, top female politicians of the world, and constantly the Prime Minister of New Zealand would be plastered on that, Jacinda, whatever. What they never mention is that the only way she got into power, and she was, this was her governing coalition until last year, they had another election, they changed it up. But in PR systems, because you have so much choice, very rarely does one party have the 50 plus majority seats to form a government. So it forces a cross-pollination of ideas with other, sometimes radically different parties. So even though she represented the kind of social democrat center left, her natural governing partner became the New Zealand First Party, which was like the Trump Paleo Gun Party of New Zealand. And she had to borrow a lot of their ideas. So they had to work together in government for her first couple of years in office. And I think that speaks to the elegance of those systems, because you could get, you know, an interesting center left or center right party in, if you had a PR here in America. And then the party that I think spoke to some of these issues around calling out maybe draconian lockdown or vaccine mandates, or, you know, working on surveillance or on tax issues where there is kind of like a populist left-right dynamic, one of these more centrist parties that probably would receive the most votes and get the first choice in forming a government would have to coalition and adopt those ideas. So it's better. Anyways, better system.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would agree, because especially now it feels like the outdatedness of this feels heightened now because, well, a lot of the GOP and the DNC, in my opinion, seem very similar. And you know, I think things like being anti-war and the wealth trend, like in the GOP debate, a lot of these Republicans were talking about being anti-regime change. There was a libertarian bent of the Rand Paul saying that and Trump saying that. And this is something that's said on the left or whatever. So like I feel like this used to be a culture war issue. It used to be like if you were a leftist, you were against war because you hated the troops. And this was a culture war thing. And now it's kind of redounded down to a class thing. I think COVID too. I think COVID, it's not about left or right. I don't think it's a culture war issue at all. I think it's strictly the elites are making a lot of money off of this. Big Pharma is making a lot of money off of this. And, you know, they're firing people in droves and they're justifying a segregated society off of this. Like, this doesn't seem like a culture war issue to me at all. But right now it's viewed as a cultural thing. And, you know, it's like what you were saying before about like the people you meet that sort of like seem apolitical. Like my friends are like Rogan people, like Joe Rogan people, listeners or whatever. Like they're not. They don't identify as a left or right thing. They don't. I feel like this thing is a very online thing where it's like there's people trying to one up each other of like how far left or right on social issues they are. Mm-hmm. It gets into like crazy land and like, you know, it's all for internet points or whatever. But you talk to people in real life and like they don't think like that. They're not in a constant chase for being the most, you know, controversial left or the real left or the real right on a social thing. And I feel like both of these things are very cultural and none of it is material anymore.
Yeah, you know, I saw a study a couple years ago. I might be misstating the particulars, but it basically argued that and showed a lot of evidence that political extremists in the U.S. tend to just be people with a graduate degree or, you know, highly educated because and part of the thinking here is that, you know, you kind of gather all these facts, you kind of have to represent your status with once you're in this kind of political hobbyist bubble where everyone's just talking about the latest editorial or news or whatever in your right. in your social class. And then you can really dig in because you kind of have this knowledge economy background. You can always muster up a couple sets of facts that can help you dig in, and you never have to kind of reach out and understand the other side. And after reading that study and some arguments that were spun off of that study, I just kind of looked at life really differently, because I meet all these people who are very well educated and have these kind of extreme dogmatic views. And then I just meet other folks who, and I'm generalizing, I'm sure you could find edge cases where this is not true, but like, you know, working class, middle class people who are just like, okay, I don't know. Both sides make interesting arguments, and the hypocrisy pisses me off.
Yeah. They just want a workable politics. They're not tied to one specific set of ideals, really, or another. They just want something that works for them, which is never really something that either side ultimately ends up doing.
Well, the funniest thing is that, one thing that I remember hearing from like some like neo-reaction people is they talk about like within you know, institutions, people fall into a purity spiral, right? Like they're one-upping each other with more devout and woke positions on things for social standing. And it's funny because I kind of take that and I apply it to Twitter, and it seems like it's kind of this arm race to have the more alienating position on everything.
Exactly.
And the funniest thing, and the real thing everybody wants is everybody like in these you know, in these institutions that want to outwoke each other, they want to, you know, they want to be more devout and all of that, right? And online, everybody wants to be more based, right? And the funny thing is that like normies that I will talk to, right, will just kind of, it's like, and these are just normal people by the standards of online circles are just totally politically schizophrenic and will say things that are like air quotes way more based than any leftist will say. And in you know, the next sentence, say something that a right winger, you know, will never say.
Yeah.
Right, and, exactly. it does occur to me, you know, one thing I was going to say a second ago is when we were talking about the Bernie stuff, right? And it's kind of been a while since we talked about that stuff. And we're talking about things that are really kind of meat and potatoes, kind of simple stuff that really was on the docket for discussion towards the beginning of this podcast. And it's funny how far off the reservation discourse has gotten since then.
Yes.
And how when I'm hearing this stuff back and I'm hearing Lee say it, it's like, oh, like, none of these premises ever actually like were disproved or really dismissed entirely. People just kind of like moved in insane directions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's either like, a poorly ran campaign went tits up. And so you either became part of a faction that laughs at school lunches not being able to provide milk anymore, or you're now just like an unironic Reaganite in the course of like 8 months. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And I have to imagine, I feel like I'm kind of rambling off here, so I promise I'll wrap up here in a second. I kind of just have to imagine like maybe a big part of it too is just social media just doesn't have a good impact on the discourse and like the development of people's ideas generally.
I mean, people, it's just like the psychological effects. I find myself rolling my eyes at a lot of the disinformation professionals who like analyze and obsess over the role of Facebook or WhatsApp, you know, internationally, because, you know, they've all kind of got their own biases, like what they consider disinformation, which might objectively be false. They still promote their own versions of it, you know,
of course.
Mm-hmm. That being said, like you look at these cases of like how much social media will influence the politics and culture of another society. And so clear when you look at a society that's not your own, like looking at how fake, like the studies of how fake news spreads in Sri Lanka or Myanmar, of people convincing themselves that like some grainy image of like some red stuff on a cloth is evidence that, you know, one tribe is poisoning the milk and putting, you know, chemicals in the food of another tribe and causing infertilization. It's like, and then people go out and lynch each other and engage in mass violence over like viral images. It's like there's so much downstream effects of social media. I think, you know, you see this kind of, you see these tweets or these Facebook items that argue on the left side on with a racial essentialist view, and you see it with like a 50,000 retweets, and you're like, okay, then this must be kind of true. At least it resonates with people. And I think it's both a bubble where they're elites who just are completely detached from everyday American society, but they have these downstream effects on the culture and on how other elites operate. It's not easy to kind of look at and correct for, because I don't agree with this kind of any mass censorship on social media, but it obviously has a negative effect on society and how our elites operate and how they view themselves in the mirror.
100%. I mean, I think it doesn't really get talked about enough, but like, it's kind of simple and it needs to be kept in mind that like, you know, you look at, and this isn't me doing my, you know, China celebration or anything like that, but China, you know, they have their own social media platforms and things like that, and it's pretty simple why they do that is because social media is like an arm of power out of the United States, and
digital type of imperialism.
Yeah, it's soft power, right? And it's pretty straightforward, and so you know, I do know that people, you hear someone say the good old classic Twitter isn't real life, and it's usually a little bit overly dismissive. And then you have the people come to the other side that say, Twitter isn't, Twitter can't be dismissed that much because there's real sway that starts here and things like that. And, you know, I'm sorry, but like a lot of these posts that'll just be like some fucking girl who just got a latte who just like says some random benign thing. Like I think like a few months ago, I saw some girl post like hot girls like pickles, and it got like 300,000 likes or something. Right. It's just like nonsense. Right.
AstroTurf.
Like that's not real. Like there are bot accounts boosting these things.
Yeah, for sure.
And like, this stuff is always in bed with the State Department and with arms of the state. And it's kind of insane that this stuff even needs to be reiterated that much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of social media functions in this political binary that we're talking about, because a lot of the functions of social media are binary. Like you can either fave something. If you're on Reddit, you can upvote or downvote, and that's pretty much it. You know what I mean? If you say something that the people in that sub don't like, or that community don't like, or that echo chamber don't like, you get booted out. You get, you know, I mean, everything is getting very binary.
You know, we're human beings. You know, we're enslaved to confirmation bias. We have our own narratives, and then social media will deliver facts or images that confirm your narrative on a platter and make you higher on your own supply and feel like you don't need to see the world. You don't need to see opposing views because you can just form your niche immediately. And it's not just for the average consumer. I think it's melting the brains of the elites too, of people who are in positions of power. They are starting to believe these crude, either I'd say less so even these right-wing stereotypes, more so these left-wing stereotypes about society that are just unrepresentative. But you can just find all these tweets or Facebook posts that lead you in the other direction. And you know, like talking about the Bernie thing, another interesting dynamic. You know, I talked to a lot of the Bernie people and some of their people in that world who are just so certain that Bernie's populist working class politics is, you know, support for immigration reform is why he did well among Latinos in Nevada. And and Latinos would support him no matter what because of these material policies. You know, another interesting dynamic about the Latino vote in 2020, there's all these polls that also show that, remember the Tom Cotton op-ed in the New York Times that first week of the Floyd protests that called for deploying troops? And then, you know, the New York Times editor Bennett resigned and all these other people resigned and they were forced out. And they tried to censor that because everyone said that was violence to, you know, write an opinion column like that at that moment. They took polls and they said that this was white supremacy to have troops quell these protests, these riots. There are also polls that showed that racially, in terms of demographics, the group that was most in favor of deploying troops to put down these riots were Latinos. And consistently throughout last year, there's all these polls that show that Latinos are among the racial group that's most in favor of law and order policies. Now, does that mean it's like not a white supremacist issue? It might be a white supremacist issue. Like certainly white supremacists might in the Venn diagram agree, but it's this white black, you know, left right racist anti-racist thing just doesn't seem to work. Absolutely. If you're talking about a marginalized community that wants more police and more cops deployed, like, can if Bernie says that, you know, he's reaching out to this community or any left-wing politician, but does not really reflect this reality. They like law and order. They oppose this defund and abolish police. They certainly oppose mass rioting. Who speaks to that?
Well, right? this is funny because I think we discussed this recently. Like the conservative wing of the Democratic Party seems like it's been for a while like the minority vote. And it seems like this managerial class that they court is the much more progressively minded. I mean, those are the people voting for fucking police abolition. It's not the people that are actually living in areas where, you know, a privatized loot crate police alternative is a viable option. It's absolutely hilarious. And of course, this is where I would definitely be interested to hear what your thoughts are on this. I mean, it's some clown car kind of stuff.
Diversify the Republican Party. Like every far left analysis of Trump on race and voters was wrong.
Yep,
Trump increased the vote share for Republicans among African Americans, Latinos, and Asians, and he has cleansed the party of the trajectory we've seen since the 70s of it becoming more and more white. The whites gravitated to the Democratic Party.
When those Hispanics were voting for Trump and they were like, oh, they're technically white Cubans.
No, literally, bro, that's exactly what I was just going to say. I was going to ask what the take is on that of the like after, you know, you see there's this 1619 lady. Right. And she's talking about politically black, politically white. We're doing a throwback right now. Right. And then you have that CNN article about multicolored white supremacy or things like that. I mean, are there people that are buying this? Are there it's interesting to me. I have to wonder what
I think white is just a pejorative now. You know, yes. So if you don't like something, if you want to insult someone, it's okay to use a racial term to insult them. And just because it's white, you know, if you don't like something, that's too white. If they're voting the wrong way, they're acting white. You know, it's just a slur, but it's a culturally accepted one. No.
Yeah. You think in the media, a lot of that stuff is more so top down, or you think that it's being just reflected because of the class of these people in the media positions? That's actually their true beliefs and their interests.
I think it's across the board. Maybe it's a little bit more popular with Gen Z people that they feel like they don't really have a working definition of racism and racial bias or racial justice, but they kind of go through the motions of you're supposed to hate or, you know, express anger towards certain groups and you're supposed to privilege and or, you know, stereotype as, you know, honorable victims, other groups. I mean, I think it's pretty simplistic, but it's a force that it's spreading throughout society and infecting everyone. So I don't know. I definitely just anecdotally see it more with young folks, but plenty of older people are also speaking this new language.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the debate that comes up a lot that we have is a lot of this ideology being internalized and then more decentrally utilized and front run in that way, or is it being kind of top down, you know, encouraged through institutional means and that type of.
Well, like, I mean, look, a lot of this comes from some foundational texts that have now become, you know, part of institutions of learning, of corporate HR departments, of foundations, of political groups, of movements that are just, you know, either wrong or just have lies of omission. You know, like there's like one thing that you just see everywhere is like, okay, the disparity fallacy that, you know, anytime there's a racial disparity, then bam, that means that's motivated by racism, even if there are other dynamics at play. Or, you know, if the disparity fallacy then hurts whites, then they just have no answer for it. Like, the spelling bee is always won now by non-whites. South Asians dominate the spelling bee. Does that mean the spelling, the English language or spelling the English language is inherently racist against whites? Obviously not. But the disparity fallacy has been thrown around everywhere because if you look at, you know, testing, you know, whatever, the criminal justice system. People see the disparities, they assume racism. They don't know the modern history of the criminal justice system. If you look at the three strikes law in California, mandatory minimums, gun sentencing, mandatory kind of add-on sentencing for a gun, for a weapon. You look at all these laws that have created, you know, a horrible over-incarceration problem. People put in prison for too long in conditions that are horrible. That does disproportionately affect African-Americans and Latinos. But the intent there was not necessarily racist. Like you look at, okay, you look at this mandatory minimum law, no matter what state you're in. I mean, I grew up in Maryland, live in California now, and it's the same case for both states. I've looked up the history. You look at the history of the mandatory minimum state laws, they were supported by the African-American legislative caucus in both states because, you know, a lot of these legislators represented districts where they had insanely high levels of crime. And they thought that this was, they thought this was a wise policymaking choice to decrease the violence. And it had these kind of unintentional consequences of destroying so many lives. Does that make it white supremacist? I don't think so. I think, you know, we have to look at this just through the actual legislative history. Look at the intent. Don't just see the disparities and assume there's racist intent.
Well, it's all like consequentialist. And that's the funny. And that's one of the funniest things is that this reminds me of what you were saying earlier about like, well, there's certain savvy actors that know how to work this and they don't back themselves into a corner with it. Right. And there's others that don't. Right. Talking about that Bernie ad. And a really great example of this that's going on right now to me is with COVID passports, right? And movement, you know, dining in restaurants, things like that. People are hammering on that because it disproportionately affects, you know, Black and brown people and all that, right? That narrative is basically just as far as I can tell, just completely ignored because they have backed themselves into a corner. And by their logic and how they measure these things, there's not really any coherent response to it.
Ibram Kendi was asked about this. I don't know if you saw this. Someone in the Q&A asked him at one of his events, you know, you say that all disparity is inherently racist. If that's true, are vaccine mandates racist because, you know, you have higher numbers of African-Americans who are unvaccinated? And he pauses for a second, then immediately pivots and goes, African-Americans don't have access to the vaccine, which is...
nice. Yo, shout out to him. Yeah. Hey, good move.
Good move. I like that. Yeah. He deserves the tens of millions of dollars.
He's keeping the grift alive. You got to respect
it. He's working
it.
Hard. He's clocking in for that. Yeah.
More power to him.
No, I mean, yeah. COVID, the vaccines where there's this sort of thing that doesn't neatly line up with race. Like, we're talking about things that generally don't neatly... split along racial lines, don't neatly split along right-left lines, and yeah, vaccine as well, like that's a big thing. And crime as well, you know, crime is not like neatly a racial or left-right thing. I mean, in the 90s, what, the Biden and Hillary and a lot of these Democrats were making all these appeals about crime.
The Congressional Black Caucus helped save the 94 crime bill, where some of its biggest spokesmen, you know. They're not something that... I think is really talked about that they want to make this a narrative of white supremacy, where it's really the story of the modern criminal justice system is a reaction and overreaction to really scary and violent crime. I mean, we're getting back to those levels. Look, in terms of U.S. service members, you know, active duty soldiers, look at the last couple of years in Afghanistan. It's 10, 11, 12 people killed per year. Look at one weekend in Chicago, one weekend in Oakland. It's more than an entire year of U.S. casualties in a war like Afghanistan.
That's all part of the plan. So there's nobody cares.
No one cares. Yeah. I mean, we have an active civil war in this country. If you look at in terms of the number of gun homicides, this is a crisis that normal people care about, but you're not allowed to talk about it in the media because, you know, there is kind of an ugly history of racial tropes of, you know, of people of the media creating narratives that are bigoted and biased about African-American men. But the victims of these crimes are also African-American men, you know, and I think if you look in these communities, you look in East Oakland, you have this huge mass support among working class African-Americans who want more police officers better trained. And this is the case in New York City that powered Eric Adams' run. That was the case in Buffalo. That's why the only candidate on the ballot India Walton still lost to a write-in candidate who just promised more funding for the police and promised not to cut them. That's why the abolish the police ballot initiative in Minneapolis just a few weeks ago failed, and that the African-American precincts of that city overwhelmingly voted to reject the abolish the police ballot initiative. You see this, the actual facts of the polling of the election results clearly show that the broad non-white working class wants respectful, well-trained professional policing because they're the ones who are disproportionately targeted by criminals. It's really this kind of out-of-touch, over-educated elite that's pushing this narrative that trickles down to the rest of society and deeply affects the left.
Yeah, it's a lot of this woke stuff too that is pushed down on the underclass, and like underclass minorities just generally don't like, or underclass people in the third world just generally don't like a lot of this woke stuff, and they just push it down and assume that they like this. And there's people on the right that assume that, like, oh, you know, black people don't care about crime because they're committing it or whatever. So I'm making a broad generalization, of course, but like, you know, there's a lot of black people, underclass black people, that don't like crime. Like this is where it becomes like a universal thing where it's not really a neat black, white, or
well, you know, I think thing. there's kind of a misalignment too. On the far right, you see these voices saying the people immigrant to the U.S. hate this country and are going to vote Democrat all the time. That's where it's like they're projecting. Actually, yeah, you look at these immigrant communities, whether it's from Korea or from Ghana or wherever, these people are coming to this country because they love it here, because they believe in the system. They believe in capitalism. They believe in creating a small business, and they support the police. And a lot of their values actually align with at least the traditional Republican Party. A lot of the far right voices are completely out of touch. And if you look at these recent voting trends, like the mayoral election in New York, you have these extremely immigrant Asian precincts that flipped GOP recently. You look in South Texas, all these like border counties flipping Republican. In Manassas Park, the most Latino, almost completely immigrant precinct in Virginia in the last Virginia election had a big swing to the Republican Party. The Republican Party, I think, is, you know, they have their own kind of identitarian, not racial, but kind of like nationalist problem where they can't see in front of them because they're so captured by their own internal polarization in politics, where if they actually go out and talk to these immigrant communities, they'll realize that those are conservative voters.
Yeah, that's where they lose me a lot of the time, because like I think it's important to talk about the negative impact that unchecked immigration and stuff can have on the labor force in America for American workers, and kind of how, you know, they can sometimes act as a way to undercut the labor market for American workers and their jobs and security. But at the same time, they lose me when they start talking about, well, you know, it's demographic change is what it is, because they want to change the soul of the nation and change, you know, they're going to be voting for these Democrats that are these, you know, radical leftists. And ultimately, like you're saying, a lot of these people hold culturally conservative views as well. Like a lot of South American cultures are a little bit more culturally conservative. So
I mean, if they're talking about deporting folks who don't share American values, it's not these immigrants. It's these eighth generation Americans with trust funds who don't love our country, who are trying to destroy its institutions and make it less safe, less secure, and have a pathological hatred of their own neighbors. You know, it's not the recent immigrants, the folks who've been here forever, who are actually very wealthy, who are unpatriotic.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, to the extent that people are coming into the country and having like allegiance toward, you know, the Democrat Party or whatever, it's based on relationships of patronage, you know? And so at that point, like if you're just treating it as this buy that's obviously going to go to your political opponent, you're kind of just leaving that on the table. Now, like, I don't think that's not me saying that, you know, like unfettered immigration into the country is doesn't have issues to it or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of absurd to just insist that they're just going to default vote Democrat all the way along. When again, like you could literally just speak to this demographic and win their vote. You know, the person, you know, the little abuela moving up, you know, who's devoutly Catholic is certainly not going to have a lot of the same American hating ideas and ideas about gender and things like that, that some bougie, overeducated, you know, person in a city is going to have. And it's obviously kind of racially based.
It's because these people are typically going to be lower class individuals who are having to work every single day in the real actual world and in material reality. And so when you're actually working through the struggle, instead of looking down on it from some academic lens, your understanding of it is so much different, because you're a little bit more focused on tangible things that can happen right now, you know, and what are some things that pop up in the nitty gritty of all of it, and some of the more gray area type of decisions that have to be made.
Also, you have a material connection to your actual workplace. Like you absolutely have physical buildings matter. If you're running a grocery, if you're running a liquor store, if you're driving a car for your business, you know, the conditions within your city matter deeply. If you're a designer, engineer, lawyer, reporter, or, you know, any of these like knowledge-based, highly educated jobs, you can get up and, you know, do your meetings on Zoom and actually live the rest of your life in Iceland. And, you know, you have no connection to cities and places and physical things. So when you see this rioting and mass violence or creeping up violent crime, you know, it's easy to be detached because, you know, you're in an Airbnb if you're part of the elite and you're not part of the, you're not connected to the real world. A lot of these immigrant communities who the Republican Party has really ostracized in really dangerous ways are connected more to the cities that are experiencing this violence, experiencing this higher level of criminality. And they're naturally connected to the kind of traditional argument of conservatives here. It's just this kind of insane polarization that makes that connection impossible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has become a controversial opinion recently, but like, I think crime is correlated with economic factors.
Of course.
You know, if you're on the left, it's because of white supremacy, or if you're on the right, it's because of black people or whatever. Like, it's all become like racial reductionist stuff.
It's abstracted.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you know, I don't know how it's become controversial now, but like, yeah, if you're in an underclass area and you happen to be minority, which odds are you will be, you're going to feel the effects of crime, and you're going to dislike crime because it's literally outside your door and it's affecting you and it's killing people related to you. It's a very visceral thing. So it's really amazing how these things that are very real and tangible and not abstract in the media scape and in the political scape, they turn into a racial reductionist thing, or they turn into this right left thing when it's, you know, ask anybody who's living in it, and it's not. It's clearly not.
Or they just get lost in the shuffle altogether, and they're never talked about or addressed as anything, issues that deserve any time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And yeah, it's a very weird thing. The crime thing I think that's a good example of it, because it's a very potent political issue.
And now there's unlimited money for the woke position after last year, that all these corporations to kind of pay their indulgences, you know, do the right PR thing. They threw money at these woke foundations and folks like Jeff Bezos's ex-wife. There's this VC guy who had a nasty divorce, I think, and his ex-wife is now a big funder of woke foundations. George Soros is now throwing money at identitarian stuff that he really didn't do in the past. And so, you know, it's kind of supercharged too from the billionaire class that, you know, I don't think we've seen the full ramifications, that you have hundreds of millions of dollars in these tax-exempt foundations funding these unaccountable activists, elite activists, who are so detached from the working class. Like, I just think, I mean, in some ways, you know, society is coming around and reevaluating some of these arguments around defund that were abolished, and a lot of these departments that have been cut have clawed the money back, and we've had these big elections where these ideas have been soundly rejected. But still, we don't see the full ramification now that it's been supercharged with this money, and these groups are just getting going.
Yeah, which is a thing that you know, some people on the right miss, of like, they'll make it like, oh, this isn't really about capitalism, this isn't really about elites or anything economic, and like, these people that are in the highest positions are pushing woke agendas or pushing woke misinformation. Like, they're the ones pushing it. Like, there's a money trail to it, but for some reason there's no connection to it.
I mean,
it.
They even admitted it with that Time article when they talk about, you know, there was a secret elite funded cabal that helped to secure the fate of the 2020 election, and how, you know, all of these people in high positions of power as far as swaying information, like Mark Zuckerberg or our guy from Twitter, I'm spacing on his name right now, but
Dorsey.
How they Yep. And how they met with, you know, all these NGO groups and stuff like that, that had very specific goals in mind, and very on message talking points that they'd like to, you know, make sure were brought to the forefront. And then there was a lot of change in misinformation policy for Facebook and what constituted as misinformation and what didn't. And then there were algorithmic changes across the board as well. And so you start to see that, well, a lot of this stuff is actually being not only supported, but they're manipulating the worldview so that you're really only engaging with these types of topics and ideas in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, has a single Facebook censor really gone after the woke misinformation on crime and policing?
Of course not.
Like if you see someone say, oh, policing was founded as a slave catching enterprise in America, which is not true. But does that get censored? Of course not, you know?
right. And I don't know if you have to leave soon.
I got to bounce.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate you coming on. Is there anything you wanted to plug before we go?
Where we can find your writing currently? And
the last 6 years, I've only written for The Intercept, so you can check.
Perfect. Awesome, man. Well, thank you for coming on, man. We really appreciate it.
Definitely.
All right, that was part one of our episode. If you'd like to listen to part two, you can find that at patreon.com/fedpost. Thanks for listening.